I think we'll move now to the final speaker, which is my former graduate student colleague, Jerome Friedman. We spent a lot of time together in courses with Enrico Fermi, and so you'll hear one of Fermi's last students give this talk.
Sorry for this little delay to get the computer set up. I just want to show a few photographs today. Well, let me start while this is booting up. It's really a great pleasure to be here today to participate in this special session on remembering Enrico Fermi. As Fermi's last graduate student, I was asked to give my reminiscences of this great man, which covered the period from 1951 to 1954. Excuse me. However, I do so with some hesitancy because time has no doubt clouded my memory and colored it somewhat. Nevertheless, I'll try to give you a sense of what it was like in my student days, my recollections of Fermi, and the environment which he created. Yeah, here's the photograph that Dick showed, and it's a very wonderful photograph of Fermi, which I wanted to use in the title page. In 1950, I entered the physics department at the University of Chicago. After spending 2 years in Hutchins College, it was a wonderful 2 years, a very innovative program in which I covered the liberal arts. And after 2 years, I decided to enter the physics department and fortunately was accepted. And it was really quite strange because I had absolutely no credentials in physics. And at Chicago in those days, everybody was accepted, essentially. And the way it worked was that there were some very, very difficult courses, and there's a qualifying exam and a basic exam in which people fundamentally were filtered out. And I was very lucky to have survived that regimen. The physics department was a whole new world for me, that one that was equally stimulating and demanding. The unquestioned intellectual leader of that world was Enrico Fermi. It is difficult to convey the sense of excitement that pervaded the department at that time. A number of factors combined to create this especially lively atmosphere. Among these were Fermi's brilliance, of course, and his leadership, and the absolutely outstanding faculty that he had assembled at Chicago. And the many notable physicists who came to visit Fermi also contributed to the excitement of the department. In addition, the pioneering investigations of pion proton scattering at the newly constructed synchrocyclotron gave Chicago a leadership position in experimental particle physics research. These all made the department a very special place at a very special time. When Fermi was attracted to the University of Chicago, he came with a vision to establish an institute for nuclear studies, to study nuclear and subnuclear physics with the most powerful tools that could be made available at that time. Here is the Here is actually Fermi with Hutchins, who was then the president of the University of Chicago, placing the cornerstone of the new institute. And this was a very important time because a great new institute was being developed. And here is the ribbon cutting. And it was very interesting there because at this ribbon cutting for the institute, there was a general from the Air Force, a general from the Army, an admiral from the Navy. There were private donors to the institute. There were representatives from the Standard Oil Company and the Shell Oil Company. And, of course, representatives from the University of Chicago. So this was the ribbon cutting day. And this is a very wonderful photograph of that. And here is the institute that was built. And you can see behind it is a small building there. You can see going in this direction. And that's where the accelerators were. 100 MeV betatron was completed at the institute in 1950. And in 1951, a 450 MeV synchrocyclotron was brought into operation. For a few years, the synchrocyclotron was the most powerful accelerator in the world. It had the highest energy. It wasn't until 1953, at which the cosmotron was started, at which there were higher energies available. And here is a picture of the betatron, and here is a picture of the here is the cyclotron being constructed in the accelerator building. And this is an interesting picture here because it shows you how the scale of physics changes very rapidly in a very short time. On the left, actually, is a cover of Life magazine. Because when the cyclotron was being constructed, it was the highest energy machine in the world, and it got quite a bit of publicity. And as you can see, there was a cover of Life magazine. By about 1970, the early 70s, the cyclotron magnet was moved over to Fermilab and became a magnet and an experiment. It was used in N898. It was an analyzing magnet. It was used in experiments which studied muon nucleon scattering. So this really shows you how rapidly the scale of physics was changing and has changed. Fermi's vision for advancing high-energy physics was sadly cut short by his untimely death in 1954. But in his short time at the University of Chicago, he led the effort that discovered the so-called 3-3 resonance, which is a resonance for isotopic spin 3 halves and spin 3 halves. His work also confirmed charge symmetry and also confirmed the conservation of isotopic spin in the strong interaction. So there was a lot that he did. And this was in addition to the theoretical work he did in astrophysics that you've heard about, and also his work in high-energy particle production. The discovery of the 3-3 resonance really was an extremely important discovery because it was the first indication of the substructure of the nucleon. And, of course, now we regard it as either an excited state of the nucleon or of a new baryon that exists at spin 3 halves. He was a very careful experimentalist who delved into all technical aspects of an experiment, often making suggestions that were critical to the success of the experiment. And Dick told you some very interesting details about this. He also developed his own statistical methods, which he taught to his students and others. And one of his great admonitions was to his students was, do not underestimate your systematic errors. He was very, very careful. He was a very careful experimentalist. And he wasn't one to jump to conclusions. It took him some time before he accepted the validity of the 3-3 resonance. And I can remember that in his talks, he always left the door open for the possibility that it was not a true resonance, because one of the solutions in the early days had the 3-3 phase shift going close to 90 degrees and then turning around. And therefore, he was very, very circumspect about it. The discovery of that resonance was only confirmed by other experiments somewhat later, actually after his death. One at Chicago did it, and of course there were a number of experiments at the Cosmotron which confirmed the 3-3 resonance. And here is an interesting slide of Fermi at the cyclotron. It's Herb Anderson and John Marshall. Those two supervised the construction of the cyclotron. And here's a wonderful picture of Fermi sitting in the control room of the synchrocyclotron. And he was often there looking at the various meters and adjusting things. But here's the first experimental indication of the 3-3 resonance. It was published in 1952. A later experiment, scattering of pi plus and pi minus on deuterium, which are charge symmetric reactions, which confirmed charge symmetry and also gave further evidence of the 3-3 resonance. And this was a later experiment by Anderson, Davidon, Glicksman, and Kruse, which actually confirmed it at Chicago in the sense that they got the 3-3 phase shift to go through 90 degrees. The actual value is about 98 degrees. So that's a little bit about the 3-3 resonance that he basically set the effort toward discovering and made the first real demonstrations of his existence. My first recollection of Fermi is of a talk he gave to the incoming students in my class. I vividly remember his advice to us to become experimentalists because the time was especially ripe for great progress in experimental physics. And field theory was at a dead end in those days. Many of us had wanted to be theorists, but when we heard the advice from this great man, obviously, we all became experimentalists. And as a result, there were really very, very few theorists in our class. I mean, maybe one or two. Fermi's influence was enormous. My next contact with Fermi occurred when I was a student in his famous courses in thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, which were given in the autumn of 51 and the spring of 1952. These were extraordinary courses, covering, in addition to classical physics, many aspects of atomic physics, nuclear physics, condensed matter physics, and astrophysics. It was clear to us that Fermi had enormous breadth as well as depth. And in his knowledge of physics, he encompassed all of physics. He was the universal physicist, experimentalist, theorist, and he covered all aspects of it. In the winter and spring of 1952, he gave courses in nuclear and particle physics and covered virtually all that was known in these two courses, in these two areas, which were closely related in those days. The distinction between particle physics and nuclear physics was not very great in those days. His presentations were the ultimate in clarity, and his legendary physical approach to demystifying problems often gave students the impressions that the results were obvious. But as has been said, but they were not so obvious when we tried to reproduce them in our own rooms. And because we didn't have Fermi's powerful physical insight and his ability to simplify complex problems. Nevertheless, we all tried to emulate Fermi's approach to solving problems. Fermi did more than his share of teaching at the University of Chicago. The usual teaching load was one course per quarter for three quarters out of four. He surpassed this by teaching 23 courses in 7 years, covering nearly the entire physics curriculum, including three freshman courses. Here's Fermi's teaching record. And you can see what the range is. He even gave a course in the physics of solids. And it was just amazing what he covered. When I passed the PhD examination, called the basic exam, I summoned up all my courage to ask Fermi if I could do my doctoral research under his supervision. To my great surprise, he said yes, and I was overjoyed to be given this wonderful opportunity. And he didn't even ask me about my qualifications, which just amazed me. And had he not asked me about my qualifications, I might not have survived. But it was really quite a privilege to be given this opportunity. The emulsion lab that Fermi had established became the center of my activities. The lab's day-to-day operations were looked after by Art Rosenfeld and some of the other people who were working in the lab at that time were Jay O'Rear, Gurang Yod, Elliot Silverstein, Bob Swanson, and Horace Taft. Fermi was highly solicitous with regard to having his students understand physics. With patience and good humor, he was invariably willing to explain any aspect of physics that had escaped our understanding. And he felt he could explain anything to anybody, essentially. He always thought a good teacher could do that. He had obvious pleasure in explaining his insights to the students, and he was readily available. As I recall, when his office door was open, which was often, one could always go in to see him. Only when it was closed did one have to knock to see if he was available. On a few occasions, he invited me to social gatherings at his home. He and his elegant wife, Laura, could not have been more hospitable and gracious. He personally took me, a very junior graduate student, around the room to meet his guest. This was another measure of his regard for his students. His students were his extended family. Often there were parlor games at these social gatherings, and Fermi was very, very competitive in these and clearly liked to win. I noticed that about 10:30 in the evening, all of the guests almost simultaneously left. I was told that Fermi went to bed early, and all of his guests were aware of this. He was meticulous about time. Speakers at seminars were told that they would have to finish by 6 p.m. if they wanted Fermi to be present for their entire presentation. He always promptly left at that time and arrived at work before 8 o'clock in the morning. This is a wonderful picture taken by Uri Habersham, who is a student of Fermi's, of Fermi playing table football. And you can see sort of the intensity with which he's playing. Fermi always wanted to be successful in such games. And this sort of typifies how Fermi attacked these challenges. Fermi was a cheerful man with a good sense of humor. He appeared to greatly enjoy the annual Christmas parties at which the students and young faculty put on skits that poke fun at senior members of the faculty. Valentine Telegdi, who was a junior faculty member at the time, had an uncanny ability to imitate some of the stellar figures in physics. His ability to imitate Fermi was remarkable. At one Christmas party, Val was enclosed in a huge box with flashing lights that represented a computer and was labeled with the name the ENRIAC or Fermiac, I can't remember which. Fermi's voice emanated from the box in a very slow and authoritative manner. This computing machine was supposed to be able to answer any order of magnitude question that was put before it. And some hilarious tests resulted to Fermi's great amusement. He clearly found this very funny. Often in lectures, he would insert quips that displayed his humor and his sense of irony. He also was a modest man. Whenever the subject of Fermi statistics came up in his lectures, he would use the phrase, "statistics that obey the Pauli principle." Not only had I been a cyclotron operator during some of his pion-proton experiments, I was later an occasional helper on his cyclotron runs. During one run, there was something that had to be made in the machine shop, and I offered to do it for him. But it was clear that he wanted to do it himself. This man of genius did not consider working in the machine shop beneath him, and he actually seemed to enjoy it. He had his own machine shop, as you were told, next to his office, in which he shared with his students and postdocs. When the plans for the institute were being developed, he apparently made sure that he would have his own machine shop. It is my impression that he took special pleasure in the mechanical devices he designed and made. One of these was the internal target mover that Dick described, and often referred to as Fermi's trolley. Another was the mechanical analog of strong focusing that he gleefully demonstrated at a colloquium that he gave. And here's another picture of the trolley. And I must say that the competing cyclotrons had trouble changing pion energy. They didn't have such an ingenious device. And the change energy required actually sometimes opening the cyclotron tank and moving targets. And this really put Chicago at a great competitive edge for carrying out the experiments, because you could change pion energy very, very quickly. Fermi, clearly, was an egalitarian man. He participated in every aspect of experiment, even the dirty parts. He clearly was a hands-on experimentalist. And here's a picture I like very much, because this was a typical image of Fermi going to the equipment, checking things out himself, and not relying on others to do it for him. Fermi's presence in Chicago not only attracted an outstanding faculty, but he also drew some of the most renowned physicists in the world as visitors at Chicago. I clearly remember Pauli and Heisenberg's visits and the excitement their presence created among the students. Up-and-coming young physicists were also attracted. He hired Murray Gell-Mann just out of graduate school, and Feynman visited a few times to give Fermi private lectures about his latest calculations, and the people working with Fermi were invited to these lectures. I can recall Fermi listening with a smile on his face as Feynman, speaking with a somewhat exaggerated Brooklyn accent and great animation, flailing his arms, reported his latest results on helium to Fermi. We had many illustrious speakers at the seminars and colloquia. Fermi inevitably would have penetrating comments and questions. His questions were gentle, but sometimes devastating to the speaker. And they usually started off with the phrase, "There is something I do not understand." And then it was a problem for the speaker. After seminars and colloquia, Fermi and Teller often had fascinating exchanges, which sometimes were very much like sparring matches. I often felt that I was observing the discourse of titans who spoke in a language that I did not yet fully understand. And here's a nice picture of Fermi and Teller in the quadrangles talking. Very often that was a place where the faculty got together to discuss things. For my thesis work, Fermi suggested that I carry out a nuclear emulsion investigation of proton polarization produced by nuclear scattering, an effect that had been observed at cyclotron energies. The objective of this study was to determine whether the polarization resulted from elastic or inelastic scattering. I did not know at that time that Fermi had already theoretically shown that elastic nuclear scattering could produce large polarizations. The calculation was in his famous notebook of problems that he had investigated and solved. The calculation was was as usual based on a simple model utilizing a real and imaginary nuclear potential and a spin orbit coupling term. This was the same term that was discussed by Dick that Fermi had suggested to Maria Mayer as possibly playing a role in the structure of the nucleus, and which was crucial to her development of the shell model. When I had only partially completed my scanning of the emulsion plates that I had exposed, Segre visited Fermi and told him that he had observed large polarizations and nuclear elastic scattering in a counter experiment at the Berkeley cyclotron. According to Segre, on the morning of the visit, Fermi calculated the polarization produced in elastic scattering, and his results matched Segre's measurements beautifully. I had been scooped and was quite dejected. However, Fermi was very understanding and suggested that I continue my measurements. First, it would be valuable to to confirm Segre's results with another technique. And secondly, I could also determine to what extent any elastic scattering produced polarization. During this period, I also sat in on Fermi's wonderful courses in quantum mechanics, which were given in the winter and spring of 1954. These were the last courses that Fermi gave at Chicago. That summer, he went to Italy, where he became ill. When he returned to Chicago in September, I saw him in the corridor at the Institute. We were some distance apart, and we waved to one another. I was struck by how gaunt he looked. The next day, he underwent exploratory surgery at Billings Hospital and was found to have inoperable cancer. I never saw him again. Chandrakasart told me that when he and Herb Anderson first went to visit Fermi at the hospital, they were initially at a loss for words. What do you say to a dying man, a man who has a terminal illness? Fermi sensed this and put them at ease by asking, "Tell me, Chandra, when I die, will I come back as an elephant?" After that remark, the conversation proceeded smoothly. Fermi was truly a remarkable man in all respects. Fermi died on November 28, 1954. It was a terrible loss, not only for our department, but also for the world of physics. A bright light had been extinguished. In 1955, I completed the project that Fermi had assigned me, verifying Segre's results with different nuclei and showing that at cyclotron energies, highly inelastic scattering had no measurable polarization, but that quasi-elastic scattering had a small polarization. John Marshall kindly signed my thesis, and I was very happy that I was able to publish it, because at Chicago, one could not get a PhD if one did not publish one's thesis. After Fermi's death, I was asked to gather up his books and journals for the University of Chicago. I don't remember finding any journals, but I found about four books. I no longer remember their titles or authors of the books, except for one, which was probably there for sentimental reasons. It was written by his boyhood friend, Enrico Persico. It was clear that Fermi didn't need books. He worked out everything for himself. I was indeed fortunate and privileged to have been taught and supervised by this giant of physics, and to have seen physics carried out at its very best at such an early stage in my development. Over half a century later, I still look back in awe at this great physicist and remarkable human being. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry, for such a great... Now we have time for questions. Yes.
I'd like to make some comments. I worked with Enrico Fermi at Los Alamos during the war, and I wanted to express my feelings and how what a thoughtful gentleman he was. I was working there at Los Alamos, and I had not met Fermi, nor had I seen any pictures of him, and I walked through a laboratory with a piece of equipment I was working on, and there was this man sitting on the side of a desk, and he had on a leather jacket and open shirt, and he looked very much like one of the local janitor-type people we had who were local Latinos from the valley down around Los Alamos, and he asked me a question as I started through the room. He was the only one in the room at the moment. And he asked, what is that you're working with? And in probably a very facetious way, thinking he may have been one of our janitors, I started explaining it. And then he asked me another couple of questions, which were fairly relevant. And I thought, now, who in the heck is this guy? And I was just about to tell him off in some way when Don Kirst, who was my supervisor, walked through the room. And he said, oh, Bob, I see you've met Dr. Fermi already. And that was my first impression, first meeting. And later on, Fermi worked with us pretty consistently for the next year after he moved to Los Alamos from Chicago. And one time I mentioned this to him, and in his usual way, he just grinned and smiled, and he said, yes, I realized you didn't know who I was.
More questions?
Yeah. Right there.
It was suggested at the beginning that there are a number of persons in the audience who had participated with Enrico Fermi and his work. It would be helpful if they would stand up and be recognized.
That's a very good idea.
Yes, I was wrong.
Everybody get up? Yeah. Well, that shows the progress of time, the evolution of time, which unfortunately does go only one way. Any other questions? Yes.
I just want to make a comment before we close that when I was first a student of physics, Enrico Fermi was one of my heroes, but I only knew of him. What an honor it is to hear from these gentlemen this afternoon who worked with Enrico Fermi so that they could share his legacy with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Another comment?
This is a story I heard on the 3-3 resonance, is that when the when Anderson and Nagel were taking the data down at the cyclotron, Enrico Fermi came down and looked at the data, and then he went up to his office for an hour, and he came back with the answer. So it only took him an hour to figure out what happened.
Well, as we all know, we who were at Chicago at the time were extremely privileged to have contact with this man. My colleagues who spoke worked with him directly. I was just a student in his class. And of course, this is unforgettable. And I believe that now we will close this session. And thank you for all coming and enjoy. Now, one other thing. There is some lack of distinction of where the address of the past president is going to be. And it's in Thurgood Marshall West. I was told to show this. Thank you all, and good afternoon.